from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of the tougher transitions in life must be from chemical dependency to being clean and sober. Three addiction specialists, former addicts themselves, take us through the process today on Insight. Also today, you've surely felt the high from infectious music. What exactly is that heady experience and how does it happen? A local neuroscientist will explain. And an update on our recent discussion of the pros and cons of requiring doctors and other health professionals to report bad side effects of drugs to the FDA. A pharmacist will tell you why he's opposed. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how music inspires spiritual feelings and an update to our recent discussion of the reporting of bad side effects of prescription drugs. Should doctors and other healthcare workers be forced to report adverse effects to the FDA? A pharmacist tells us why he's opposed. First, chemical dependency can be a tough thing to shake. Many addicts struggle for years, maybe forever. Today, you'll meet three addiction experts who'll take us through the process of recovery. We'll focus on meth. All three of our guests are former clients themselves of Progress House, a Sierra Foothills organization that offers residential treatment and other services to drug addicts and alcoholics. Two of them work today at Progress House. They're all in our studio. They're Tim Avey, who's executive director of Progress House, Kim McGeehy, who's account coordinator and transitional house manager at Progress House, and Laurie Stantz, who works for El Dorado County as health program specialist in the alcohol and drug program division. She's also a certified addiction specialist. So Tom, Kim, and Laurie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As I noted in the introduction, you all know of what you speak. Let's start briefly by talking about how you got involved with Progress House yourselves with your background. Tom, you were involved with alcohol.
I was involved with alcohol. I was in a veterans hospital for alcohol and was there for a month when they sent me to Progress House in 1986. And then I was there for 3 months.
Were you an alcoholic?
I was an alcoholic, still am an alcoholic.
Yes. How long had you been an alcoholic before you got treatment?
I was 40 years old when I got treatment. I started being an alcoholic at the age of 15.
I see. Also with us, Kim McGeehy. Kim, what brought you to Progress House when you were a client?
I started using methamphetamine back in high school, and it escalated, and I got into some criminal trouble, but down in Butte County where I'm from, and hit residential treatment in 1998.
Was the criminal activity because of the meth?
Yes.
And Laurie, what's your background?
Well, I used alcohol and drugs for 24 years, and in 1997, I got busted and put in jail, which I'm not a person to go to jail. It just scared me to death. And so I got out. My parents bailed me out and decided I needed to go into treatment. And so they kind of pushed me into treatment, and I went to Progress House for 2 months and did residential, and then they asked me to work there as night staff, so I stayed there for a full year.
What do you think you would be doing today if you had not been sent to jail and then made the decision to get treatment?
I don't know if I would have made the decision to get treatment if I hadn't been put in jail, if that intervention wouldn't have happened.
Kim, you're nodding.
Yep, same. I do not believe I would be where I'm at today had I not gotten into trouble and went to jail myself and went up to Progress House and did residential treatment.
Do you think that would be true of people you knew when you were, both of you, when you were using meth? Would that be true of others as well?
It's a great intervention to have that, the legal system come in. It really does help out. It's a kind of a big awareness that, you know, things are going wrong. Yeah. You know, nowadays they have more people are, more law enforcement is working harder on solving the drug problems and this and that. So they are aware of it and they are incarcerating more people. But back in the day when I was using drugs in the 70s and 80s, you know, there just wasn't a lot of law enforcement doing a lot of drug work and busting people for drugs. So,
but Tom, it sounds like you got treatment because you were sick rather than because you were in trouble with the police. Is that right?
I was not in trouble with the police. I sure was in trouble with my wife. I sure was in trouble with the family. And if I had had an option other than that, I probably would have taken it. I had no other options.
The people that you all deal with today, what percentage are alcoholics, what percentage are meth addicts, and what percentage are something else? Tom?
It's very difficult to put an actual number on it. I would say that alcohol is still the number one drug, causes much child abuse, that type thing. But methamphetamines is now probably 50% of the drug addicts that come into treatment. And you'll read statistics saying nationwide it's only 5%, different things like that. In Northern California, meth is the drug of choice. Nothing else comes close.
Well, if alcohol and meth account for it, sounds like you're seeing the majority. What's left? What's third?
There are very few people that only use meth or only use alcohol. Mm-hmm. You know, you can use meth to get up and Oxycontin to get down and marijuana to mellow out and... Very few. Most are poly-substance abusers.
What about cocaine, heroin, those kinds of drugs? Are you seeing those much?
Yes, we are. We're seeing a lot of OxyContin users and heroin users. Cocaine, not as much anymore. I think that methamphetamine is way above cocaine right now because it's an easier drug to get. It lasts longer. It's cheaper. And so marijuana is prevalent too. Mm-hmm. I work with adolescents and, you know, marijuana is real prevalent with them. And it's so accepted by society with Prop 215 and this and that. You know, the kids are getting a message that it's okay, you know.
Has meth replaced any drugs? Are the drugs that were more commonly used in the past and now the people who were using that drug are now using meth?
I think she was just stating cocaine is probably way down because meth is way up. And I think that a lot of people that used other drugs use methamphetamine as a substitute when they can't get them because it's so readily available, so cheap.
When you watch the local TV news, you hear a lot about meth being a big problem, and of course it's a problem for many reasons. But I'm interested to know if you think that there's a general increase in addiction, or is it just that there's a fixed number, say a fixed percentage of society who are addicts of one kind or another, and they'll move from one drug to another, and it's just that one drug's getting a lot of publicity. Is there a growing problem in society with addiction?
Well, as the population grows, of course, the addiction problem grows. I would say that, you know, we have our ups and downs in the years. You know, we have the studies show addiction goes up, it goes down, depending on, you know, how many people. The admissions are always up in treatment. Treatment is booming. There's more awareness within the lawmakers that treatment is necessary, that if we actually stop the demand, there won't be the supplier.
Kim, tell us how you recovered from meth. What's the process? Where do you start and where do you end, if you do end?
I don't think you ever end. When you do an honest program of sobriety and recovery, you know, you're an addict, and once you're an addict for the rest of your life. I had to hit a rock bottom for me, lost my girls, excuse me, and got into residential treatment. I did 10 months of residential treatment and then went into transitional living for 11 months and did a year and a half of outpatient before going into my own apartment with my children and applying for a job at Progress House, where I've been employed since then. You have to get a sponsor, work the steps, and, you know, stay, build that foundation. I think it's very important that you build a strong foundation for your recovery and maintain that support system. And for me, I never can forget where I came from and what a struggle it has been when I was out there, because I do not ever want to go back there. I can't.
What was it like your first night of living in a residential center, realizing that this was the first night without meth in a long time and probably, hopefully, forever?
I think it's a shell shock. It really is at first. You have a lot of feelings coming up, feelings that you've been stuffing by using and drinking. And so when you're in there, you sleep and you start eating healthy, and for me, I was done. I'd hit a bottom to where I knew I needed help and I couldn't continue on the path I was on.
Is it physically difficult coming off?
Yes.
What are the symptoms?
Well, you've been, you know, when you use meth for as long as I had, and drink too, I drank, your body, and being pregnant, I was only 9 weeks pregnant too, so I got into residential treatment. I was underweight. I was extremely tired from, you know, using, and, you know, hadn't taken care of myself physically or emotionally in so long. So it's a struggle.
Laurie, when I was asking Kim about her first night, you were smiling at each other.
Yes. I was a staff member at the time, and Kim called and said, Laurie, I can't come yet because I have to take my kids to the movies. And I said, Kim, you need to come now. You need to be here within the next 2 hours or I'm giving your bed away.
Was that a story, Kim, about the movies?
It was and it wasn't. You know, my daughter was, my dad and my stepmom were going to keep my girls while I went to residential treatment. And I was bringing my five-month-old with me and pregnant with another one. And I was, you know, but yeah, I'd been on a little run. And, you know, you almost like you know, even though I wanted to go, my heels were dug in because it's such a huge change. It was such a starting point for me to turn my life around. And that, even though I'm so grateful for doing it, it's still that last minute, do I really want to do this? You know, but you do it.
Tom, what's the difference between helping an alcoholic recover and a meth addict recover?
The recovery process is the same. The meth addict may sleep a little more at the very start. An alcoholic may have more problems detoxing at the very start. Alcohol detox is very dangerous. Meth detox is not.
What do you mean it's dangerous?
Well, if you are an alcoholic that's been continuously drinking, there's very good chance, if you don't go through a detox center, that you'll go into convulsions and could die. So of all the drugs, alcohol is probably one of the most difficult to detox safely. Methamphetamine, you're coming off it and you need a lot of sleep. Heroin, that you always hear about the detox, you feel like you want to die, but you're not going to.
What is it that stops addicts of various kinds from getting treatment? I mean, Kim and Laurie, you said that it was because you got into trouble with the law that you sought treatment. Is it this detoxing period? Is that what holds people back, or is it something else?
Well, it's very uncomfortable to detox. Absolutely. That's a really hard part, especially with the opiate addicts and with the alcoholics.
Did you know that it would be that difficult before you got treatment?
No. No, I didn't. I had no clue. There was, when I was growing up, there was just no education. You know, there wasn't any education in the schools or anything. When I went to school in the 70s and 80s, it just seemed like that there was nothing out there. I think I saw a commercial on St. Helena one time, and that was it, you know.
And Jeffrey, most addicts, alcoholics, yeah, don't think they can recover.
Yeah.
They don't believe they can recover.
Right.
They have no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't until they have what I call an iron bar intervention or something like the VA that I had, mm-hmm, where they get into a situation where they find out there is a possibility.
it seems to me that, that some addicts appear to be in denial about their problem. Do they have, is it really denial of the problem, or is it something else? Is it really what you're saying, that they, that what they're really in denial about is that they can be fixed?
Probably all of the above. I think that's a really good question. When people are in denial, they don't even know they're in denial. They don't know that there is some hope there. They don't know that they're pointing their finger at everything else in their life and saying that they didn't do anything wrong. They really don't realize this at the time. So that what part of recovery is about is teaching people to be accountable for their own actions.
Kim, what about you? What had stopped you from getting treatment for your addiction?
What had stopped me prior to getting in trouble? Just, I had been so involved in it for so long, I didn't think there was going to be a way out. You know,
Saw that you had a problem.
I did. Excuse me. And when I entered treatment in 1998, that was really my second time in residential treatment. In 1997, when I originally got in trouble with the law down in Butte County, they court ordered me to treatment. And I was in Progress House for 90 days that time. When I had 60 days in, my mom passed away from cancer. And when I went home, I went home for a funeral and relapsed and went back to the program and never told nobody. But I'd already woken up what you call that dragon. I'd woken up that disease to, you know, to get high again. So when I exited, I mean, I was only out of residential treatment for 6 months and a week to the day, and I went back in March of 1998. And during that time, I got in trouble again with the law, and I had hit that bottom. I had learned something in that original 90 days in my treatment where I had heard, I knew I needed help, I knew I was an addict, and I just didn't know how to stop. And I knew I wanted to, and I knew, so I picked up the phone and called.
So you were relieved in a way about being forced into treatment?
In a way, yeah.
What about you, Laurie? When you were ordered into treatment, were you relieved, worried?
You know, I want to kind of go back, Jeffrey, to what you were talking to about Kim. And I got to say, one of the reasons why I didn't want to quit using is because I did not want to feel the pain and the humiliation and the shame of it all, of what I had done to my family, what I had done to my children. You know, I lost almost everything I had. And I knew that if I stopped using drugs, I would have to feel those feelings. And that kept me out there a long time.
Kim and Laurie, did either of you spend any time in jail?
Yes.
You did. What was it like being an addict in jail? Was there anything to help you?
No.
So what did you do? How did you get through it?
You just sleep. Sleep it off.
Let's talk about how to get people into treatment without getting into trouble, because both you, Kim, and Laurie said that you got into treatment because you got into trouble with the law. Obviously, it would be great if people could get into treatment without getting into trouble with the law. We'd all be better off.
Right.
Your thoughts on that? Let's start with Tom.
Well, you can contact professionals in the chemical dependency industry, people from either outpatient or residential facilities, and set up interventions. And they really need to be done professionally, where you get together profession, family, you might have an employer, different people that speak to the addict or the alcoholic about how their actions affects their loved ones' lives, and have a bed ready for them when you finish that intervention. And quite often that'll help a lot.
But who's going to start that process?
It's usually the family members that call first, and I get a lot of calls from different people and asking me, because I work at the alcohol and drug division, you know, my son's out of control, you know, he's using, I know he's using, and I don't know what to do. And so it's usually the family members that kind of intervene and make that person aware that there's a problem. And then we kind of give the family members some resources on how to, you know, deal with that person. You know, give our phone, I give my phone number and I say, you know, have him call me and talk to me, and I'll talk to him about, you know, where he could go, you know, if he thinks he has a problem, whatever. You know, I'd like to make personal contact with them, though, and see where they're at.
Kim, is there any way to, for people, agencies, whatever, to directly reach people who are addicts? They're not yet in trouble, but they don't have a family member or a friend who's doing something about it.
Yes, I feel that if there's someone out there and they feel hopeless and full of shame and they're wanting help, they can start by going to a 12-step meeting, NA, AA, CA, and network, start networking there. There's wonderful people there. You know, they can go and get a phone list. People are willing to help. They'll come and take them to meetings. If they still are struggling with their addiction and having a hard time staying clean during the meetings, then they can, within that, I think they could reach out and start and call an outpatient facility if they need to, or, you know, go to the local, you know, AOD and see if there's help out there. But 12-step meetings of recovery are everywhere. They're nationwide, and they are, you know, the wonderful place to start for somebody that wants help.
Let's wrap this up by talking about parents, because I guess if children were brought up ideally, they probably wouldn't become addicted to alcohol or drugs. I'd like to hear what your thoughts on what parents should know and think about when it comes to raising their children.
You do the best you can do. And it may or may not make any difference whatsoever in their using of alcohol and drugs. I had a perfect childhood. I was an alcoholic by the time I was 15. It's a disease of the body, mind, and spirit. And your parents may do an awful lot, and it may not be enough. On the other hand, you may grow up with lousy parenting, but somehow build the resiliency that this never happens to you.
Kim, you're a parent?
Yes, I am. And, you know, I had a wonderful, I was raised in a middle-class family. You know, it's just something that happened. What's different for me as a parent is my girls have went through recovery with me, just like they went through my addiction with me. So, and I make them very aware that as they get older, should they choose to drink or anything, that they run a risk of becoming an alcoholic or an addict because of me. So they need to be aware of that.
What ages are they?
I have a 15-year-old, an 11-year-old, and an 8-year-old special needs.
Do you get the sense that the 15-year-old understands what you're talking about?
Yes, she does. Oh. She remembers me out there, and she has been with me every step of the way.
And Laurie?
I'm a parent also. I have a 22-year-old son and an 18-year-old son. And I've been sober for 9 years now. And I have tried to help them. And unfortunately, even with all my knowledge and skills, it didn't help. Both of my kids are in detention right now. And so, you know, to the parents out there, just, you know, do the best you can. Don't enable your children. Whatever you do, don't enable them. Don't make excuses for them. If they get into the system, the legal system, that's okay, because that's going to be help for them. You know, just do the best you can, but please don't blame yourself.
Well, thank you all very much. I really admire your courage in talking so frankly about your own personal situations and pasts. It was a pleasure meeting you all.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Tom Avey and Kim McGeehee, both of Progress House, and Laurie Statz of the Alcohol and Drug Program Division of El Dorado County. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, you've surely felt the high from infectious music. What exactly is that heady experience, and how does it happen? A local neuroscientist will explain. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Recently, we talked about so-called hot lanes. Those are carpool lanes changed so that solo drivers can also use them if they pay a toll. Dan in Sacramento emailed us to say, what a goofy idea. The carpool lanes were funded with funds set aside for mass transit. To allow rich people to fill a lane with Hummers is not going to bring any joy to the large number of people parked in other lanes. Gabrielle in Lincoln also emailed us to challenge the reasoning behind hot lanes. She said they might even make highway congestion worse. Quote, the number of cars stays the same, might even get more because people who now take the pain to carpool but are financially able to might then use the hot lanes. And Bob, in an unspecified location, wrote to say, if you're going to make a toll road, make a toll road. He added, if people want a private toll road, have them vote for it, telling the price per ride first. To listen again to that or any previous insight, go to our online archive at capradio.org/insight. Humans have made and appreciated music for thousands of years. One of the great appeals of music is the high you feel when you're in the groove, either as a listener or a performer. For many people, the feeling is spiritual, and that no doubt helps explain the prominent role of music in so many religions. A local neuroscientist is studying the impact of music on the brain and how it interacts with and provokes spiritual feelings. He's Peter Giannata, an assistant professor at UC Davis. Peter, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
What happens to music in our brain? What part of the brain does it work with, and what does it do?
Well, one of the things that neuroscientists have been discovering over the past half a decade or so is that you can't really talk about music being processed in just a single part of the brain. Really, it's the entire brain that's getting involved with music, and it really depends somewhat on the kind of musical activity that you're engaging with. But certainly when we're listening and we feel ourselves moving in response to the music, we're clearly engaging both perceptual parts of the brain as well as parts of the brain that are involved in sequencing actions and helping us move.
There are so many kinds of music, from nursery rhymes to Mahler symphonies to music from Africa, all around the world, all different kinds of music. Do all these kinds of music nevertheless have a similar impact on our brain, or do different kinds of music have different impacts on our brains?
That's a really good question. I think probably what it boils down to usually is what is the, is the music familiar to you or not? So we grow up in various musical cultures, and as we become familiar with various kinds of music, we develop preferences for those types of music, so forth and so on. So I think that ultimately what shapes our experience of music are those brain areas that mediate the perception action, as well as the familiarity and the emotional connections, and that despite the tremendous variety in the forms of music that are out there in the world, that ultimately at the level of the individual listener, the experiences will be relatively similarly structured in the brain.
When I'm feeling a bit stressed out in my car, one of the things I most commonly do is go to V101.1, which is the R&B oldies station. Plays a lot of funk, mainly from the 70s and 80s, but some from today. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that kind of music, but let's listen to one of the greatest examples.
Sure.
Of course, this is Superstition by Stevie Wonder. It's a funky song, and vocals coming up in just a moment. Let's listen to a bit more. Peter Giannata, what is it that's working so powerfully in this song?
Well, I think it's that beat, it's that synth line with that catchy melody in there, and so it has a very strong rhythmic quality, a nice little melodic hook. I think that really grabs a hold of the brain.
It is a catchy melody, But do you think it would be as powerful if you were just strumming the chords on an acoustic guitar in a not very musical fashion and still sang the same melody and words? Or is it the other way around, that if you took away the melody and the words and just played the backing track, the rhythm and so on, that that would be more powerful than the simple melody and lyrics?
Well, you know, there's sort of two aspects to your question there. I mean, there's an important experiential part, and I think that if you're, you know, playing it and you're feeling good about how you're playing it, that, you know, there'll be a lot of you'll have a strong emotional experience with that. But I think sort of as a listener, if I were now listening to somebody playing it not very well, or if I was mainly listening to that backing part, you know, I think it's the rhythmic drive of that backing part that's, you know, going to get my body moving.
On your research, you're collaborating with a religious studies researcher who's Robin Sylvan of the nonprofit Sacred Center in Oakland. Robin's on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is, well, I understand that you'll be studying the way that music creates or shapes spiritual experiences for several groups of people. Who are you studying?
Well, we've chosen six different test groups to try to get as wide a variety as possible, which in some sense we hope to answer some of the questions that you've asked, which is, you know, is there a universal component to music? Will all musics produce the same effect, or are they specific to specific religions? So we've chosen two Western religions. One would be a Christian church and the other a Jewish synagogue. Two non-Western religions. One would be a Hindu temple and the second would be a Yoruba African temple. And the third set of two groups would be non-religious but spiritually oriented music scenes, and that would be jam band type of scenes and electronic dance music or the rave scene.
Jam bands, examples being Grateful Dead and Fish.
Exactly.
Have you done some research already into the connection between music and spiritual feelings in any or all of those groups?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have. For my PhD research, I looked at the Grateful Dead and Deadheads. I looked at hip-hop. I looked at heavy metal, and I looked at the rave electronic dance music scene. And I should also mention that I did travel to Ghana, West Africa, to look at some of the traditional possession dances that take place in those cultures.
And what's your early take on these groups then, and how music and spiritual feelings connect?
Well, I think if you take the wide view, I think it's pretty clear that music is a nearly universal tool for helping people access the spiritual realm or connecting to the sacred. And certainly each of those groups demonstrate that. But I think the interesting thing is they demonstrate that in slightly different ways. In the same way that different religions have different feelings or emotional states associated with them, whether that be love and bliss or fear or anger or what have you, you find some of the same things taking place in different groups. So, for example, if you are a deadhead, then you're more likely to have that feeling of peace and love, whereas if you are a head-banging metalhead, you're more likely to access states of spirituality through aggression and anger and what they like to call an adrenaline rush. So there are some universal components, but I think also that each religion or each music culture articulates that in a different way.
Both of you, Peter and Robin, do either of you know how long humans have been creating music?
Well, I think there's, you know, that's an open question. It seems every few years somebody finds an older and older artifact, but I believe there's some bone flutes that date back several tens of thousands of years that have been identified. I don't know, Robin, if you know.
I don't think there's any definitive answer, but I think probably the best speculation we have based on evidence is that we've been creating music as long as we've been human, perhaps even longer. It may precede our current human body.
Do either of you know of any religious or spiritual groups that do not use music in any way to enhance or to shape their spiritual expression?
I'm not really aware of any, and, you know, this is my area of expertise, something I've been looking into for a long time.
So what do you think we can take from that, if anything?
Well, you know, this is what we hope to focus on in this study, you know, that music is one of those basic human tools for accessing spiritual worlds or accessing the sacred or creating a closer connection to God. I think of there was a famous founding ethnomusicologist who said, we're not all practicing mystics, but music is the closest thing that we all have to accessing the mystical experience.
Peter, how do you actually study the perception of music in the brain?
Through a variety of tools. Experiments range from behavioral experiments where we, let's say, have people answer questions in responses to pieces of music that we play them, or we observe their tapping behavior. We have a range of, we like to collect physiological measures also, so we do this by means of recording the EEG using electrodes that are attached to a person's scalp while they engage in various tasks or hear various stimuli. And then we also use functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to get a more detailed look at what brain regions become active as a person listens to pieces of music and experiences various emotional states or experiences various memories that are associated with those pieces of music, so forth and so on.
Well, humans aren't the only musical beings on Earth. Peter, you've studied song perception and song learning in birds. Does that shed any light on your research into how humans perceive music?
You know, maybe not as directly as one might think. I mean, there are a lot of similar issues there that have to do with how do we sequence behaviors. So both music as well as speech and song and songbirds, you're ultimately talking about sequencing, you know, pieces of auditory information through time. And music is a particularly artful way of arranging those types of sequences. And so a really big question is in neuroscience is how does the brain structure those types of sequences? How does it implement them? And so looking at things in the songbird model, those are the types of issues that one can get at there. Another very interesting sort of parallel that people muse about, and in particular when trying to answer the question, is birdsong music, has to do with issues such as creative expression and the ability to improvise. So there are some species of songbirds who have very broad vocal repertoires and can acquire new song elements fairly easily, as well as string song elements together in novel ways. And those are some of the features that are characteristic of improvisation in music. So there's potentially an interesting parallel there.
Hmm. Robin, you talked earlier about how one of the groups you'll be studying is the rave culture, and rave culture is a product of youth culture. If the people in rave culture had lived at an earlier time when there was no strong youth culture, what do you think those people would have been doing instead with that music and with that experience of music? Do you think it would have been channeled into some religious or spiritual, overtly spiritual purpose, or is it something perhaps baser than that?
Well, absolutely, I think it would be. That's kind of one of the main theses of the work that I've done, and I think in terms of adolescence, that's one of the significant rites of passage in a human being's life, that passage from adolescence to adulthood. And typically what you'll find in traditional cultures is that there absolutely is a ritual in which they are guided through that rite of passage, and typically that will involve some type of initiatic experience. Often that will involve drumming and dancing to induce some type of trance state, or it could involve a vision quest, a physical ordeal, some type of intense initiatic experience. So I think you've hit on a very important point, which is that traditional cultures have some mechanism whereby this sort of wild energy that's characteristic of this period of time in life is channeled in a productive way where they're given meaning systems, whereas I think in our current modern culture, that really doesn't happen. And so young people are seeking some type of initiatic experience. Certainly the rave scene is one of those ways that they channel that, but I think they also channel that through taking drugs or through gang violence or things of this nature. So that's a very good question.
And Peter, final question for you. Once you've finished this research into how music helps to shape and create spiritual feelings in people, would you hope that composers and musicians would look at your research, or would you, as a musician yourself, prefer that they stay away from that and continue to rely on their own gut feelings about what makes for good music?
No, I think there's a really important dialogue to be had there. I mean, in many ways, as a researcher, you know, I'm just trying to understand things that composers have understood for years, for a long time. You know, they're clearly tapping into a way of moving people through music, and then they do this very well. And so, you know, I'm sort of struggling to understand how the brain actually, you know, accomplishes all of this. But I think, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, maybe if you understand it at a scientific level, you somehow eliminate the beauty of the musical experience. And I don't think that's true at all. I mean, the more we learn about how nature works in general, it doesn't diminish the beauty of, you know, of walking through a glorious forest or something like that. And similarly, I think that understanding how music is implemented in the brain can only help sort of the dialogue between the scientists and the artists in helping structure, say, new music or new types of musical experiences for people.
Well, thank you both very much. Peter Giannata is a neuroscientist at the UC Davis Center for Mind and Brain, and Robin Sylvan is a religious studies researcher at the Sacred Center in Oakland. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, an update on our recent discussion of the pros and cons of requiring doctors and other health professionals to report bad side effects of drugs to the FDA. A pharmacist will tell you why he's opposed. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and tomorrow in Insight, you'll hear the stories of refugees from Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, Ukraine, and Laos, why they fled their homes, and what life has been like in Sacramento. A couple of weeks ago, we considered the case for requiring doctors and other healthcare workers to report the side effects they see in drugs. Right now, reporting is voluntary. Most medical and related professional associations opposed a bill in the California Senate that would have made reporting mandatory. We were unable to get a guest on that show to state why they had opposed the bill, in part because the bill was by then dead. However, the same day I got an email from a listener who's a hospital pharmacist who said he understood the motives behind the bill but maintained that side effect reporting should stay voluntary. We thought it important to hear this perspective, so we invited him on Insight. He joins us by cell phone. Pharmacist Ki San, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's first listen to a clip from our recent program on this topic. Here's State Senator Elaine Alquist, who wrote the bill that would have required licensed health professionals in California to report so-called adverse drug effects to the FDA.
If you just look at 2004, which is the latest year that I have numbers for, 770,000 ADEs occurred. This is from FDA statistics, and of those, only 422,000 were reported. And if you keep in mind that adverse drug reactions are in the top 10 cause of death in America, I think that that is significant.
Well, what Senator Alquist described sounds like a problem. Ki San, is it actually a problem?
It is a problem. It sure is a problem. One thing that has actually been reported is that actually hospital errors and adverse reactions due to them, or adverse reactions themselves, are actually going down since report from 2005. This is a problem, but the thing is, I was wondering what the impetus was for a mandatory reporting. The FDA right now, MedWatch, we do have a database.
Let's just back up here. MedWatch is the program that the Food and Drug Administration has set up to manage the process of reporting. And for manufacturers, it's mandatory, the reporting, but for licensed health professionals, it's voluntary.
Yes. Well, manufacturers have to, even after they are drugs are released, they go through a clinical four trial, which is basically monitoring. So it is mandatory for them. Well, we do we can either report to MedWatch or the drug manufacturer, which in turn does report to FDA also. But the reason why I don't feel it's a necessity is because one thing is that DHS, which is Department of Health Service, and also JACO, which is Joint Commission's accreditation on hospital organizations, set up a pretty good system in which it's necessary for hospitals ourselves to report adverse drug reactions. When they are reported to us from nurses, we do gather a database, and with every case, we looked into it. To see, and we quantitatively assess if, in actuality, if it is, there is a cause and effect from the drug causing the adverse reaction. Mind you that when a patient is sick and comes into hospital, there's a lot of things going on, disease states, food reactions, other things that can occur. Also, it can be another drug that's causing the reaction.
But that could be important and useful information for the FDA to know so that they can say, if you eat spaghetti, then you shouldn't take this drug over here.
Mm-hmm. First of all, we have to quantitatively, we go through the case, every case, and the pharmacists do this, and assess, you know, is it possible or is it not possible that the drug is causing it. This goes through to another hospital-wide committee called the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, which would in turn grade how serious the reaction is from 1 to 7, 7 being cause of death, 6 and 5 being prolonged hospitalization or admittance to a hospital. And from there on, from there, we would decide to report to MedWatch and or the drug company. So there are a few systems when it comes to hospitals that require us to report to the MedWatch. What I'm afraid of is that if it is mandatory for us to report every adverse drug reaction, it is the production of misinformation. Because, like I said, most of the time it might not be a drug that's causing the reaction itself.
But isn't it appropriate to try and figure out what was the cause?
Well,
I mean, it might have been something unrelated to the drug, but it might be.
And that's why we do it at a local level, within the interim of a hospital. And to include MedWatch into it, we only report to MedWatch if we are sure, we are positive that it is a cause of medication to cause adverse drug reaction, and if it is for good of the public health, if it is something new and something not known about the drug, then we do report it. And it is voluntary because it should be up to the discretion of the physician and the healthcare providers to weigh the risks and benefits of reporting such cases if it is deemed necessary.
Is there a possibility that that this could help out in cases where a drug was wrongly prescribed to a person, then it might be in the interest of the person who prescribed it or who managed the person's care to not publicize that because a mistake had been made?
Oh, well, when they are reported, I do not think any identification of the patient goes along with the reporting, nor does the reporting from the physician itself. I believe Okay. I'm not correct. I'm not sure if I'm correct, but I believe when we do report to MedWatch, there is no personal ID that's associated with that reporting. And I do not think it can be pulled into a litigation.
Can I try and summarize your position then, that that doctors, hospitals, pharmacists, and so on are perfectly well trained and equipped to make a decision themselves on whether or not an adverse side effect to a drug is worth reporting to the FDA or not, and that if the drug reporting were made mandatory, it would be burdensome, too burdensome.
I think, that is correct. I mean, I agree with having that information that, I did work in a drug information
We have to wrap this up quickly, Key. We're almost out of time.
Okay. And it is hard when we can find information, but what I'm afraid of, again, is just misinformation when there's too much to swim through to find if a drug is actually the cause of the reaction itself.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you joining us today. That's Key San. He's a hospital pharmacist. Key, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the remains of two of the three men who committed suicide at Guantanamo have been sent to Saudi Arabia, but many Saudis don't believe the US account of how the men died. That story and the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producer was Janet Mineri. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us.